So we have Sefer Dvarim, and we think about Sefer Dvarim split up into three different parts. The Vilna Gaon talks about how we have there are three different sections of Dvarim, and they're really widely thought to be Prakim 1 through 4, which is thought of as the introduction to the speech. So how did we get to where we are? Part number 2 is thought of as the new mitzvot and some known mitzvot. So just a smattering of some new mitzvot that we've never heard of: Egla Arufa, the Ben Sorer Mareh, the wayward son, with some old mitzvot that we're already very, very much aware of. And that's really the bulk of the speech, spanning from Prakim 5, Perek Hey, through 27, Kav Zayin. The third part of the speech is the covenant. So this new reestablishment, I called it the covenant revisited, and we'll focus on that a little bit today, where Bnei Israel go, are told that when they go into Eretz Israel, when they go into Eretz Canaan, they will go on to Har Eival, and they'll seemingly reestablish this covenant that they made with Hashem. And I'll expand on that in just a minute. And Parshat Ki Tavah is really falls. Oh, before we get to Parshat Ki Tavah, what's interesting, I think, is that the Vilna Gaon talks about how each section of Sefer Dvarim starts with the same word as one of the three books of the Torah, the previous three books of the Torah, that it's essentially setting out to summarize, or that Moshe is setting out to summarize. So the first word of the first section of the intro section starts with the word Eileh, which is the same word as Sefer Shmot starts off, Ve'eleh Shmot. The second section, Perek Hey, starts off with the word Vayikra, which is, of course, the same word as the beginning of the book, Vayikra. And the third section starts off with the word Vayidaber, which is, of course, the same word as starts off the book, Bamidbar, Vayidaber Hashem, El Moshe Lemor, Bamidbar, in the desert. Which is, it's cute, and it's a nice way of really reiterating that this is essentially a summary somehow of the previous three books. Of course, Bereishit is left out because Bereishit is thought of as an introduction maybe to the whole story of how we got to being the Jewish nation. And within that context, Parshat Ki Tavah really falls in between sections 2 and 3, meaning it's a bridge between sections 2 and 3. We have at the beginning of Parshat Ki Tavah the mitzvot of Bikurim and Maaser, followed by writing down the commandment to write down all of the mitzvot. So those still fall into the mitzvot, that mitzvot category, that laws category, which is section 2. And then it moves on to the establishments of the stones, the covenant, and then what will happen to us if we don't follow through with this brit, if we don't follow through with this covenant, which ends the parsha off with what we call the tochacha, or a series of terrible things that will happen to us, the admonitions that generally, when we read it this week, are read very quietly, lest we bring upon, we attract the evil eye essentially upon ourselves. And that's how Parshat Ki Tavah ends. Now, I want to just focus very briefly on this middle section over here, the writing down the mitzvot, and then bridging into the establishments of this new covenant of the stones. And so we'll focus on that middle section, but I wanted to distill what I just said into three major sections, starting with the mitzvah of Bikurim, bringing of the first fruits, moving on to the reestablishment of the covenant, which I'll call Brit number 2. And then, of course, the tochacha, that admonition that wraps up our parsha. And so Brit number 2 is where we'll start. And I just want to give a little bit of background to it. And essentially, the Brit has different components. The covenant that we establish in Parshat Ki Tavah has three different components. The first is that we are supposed to write Kol Divrei HaTorah HaZot, all the words of this Torah, seemingly maybe even talking about the whole Torah, or many parshanim say, many commentators say, really just focusing on Sefer Dvarim, that we're supposed to write this covenant down, write this Sefer down. Moshe builds a Mizbeach to Hashem, or he says that Bnei Israel will build a Mizbeach to Hashem when they get to Eretz Canaan. V'zavachta shlamim, they'll give a specific type of korban shlamim, and they will establish for themselves these large stones when they make this, when they establish this covenant. And what you'll notice about this covenant that we make in Parshat Ki Tavah is that it very much parallels a covenant that we made many years ago, about 40 years ago, in on Har Sinai in Exodus, in Sefer Shmot, in the after we hear about Parshat Mishpatim, at the end of Parshat Mishpatim, we see that a very similar covenant is established. Again, Vayichtov Moshe Kol Divrei Hashem, he writes down the words of God. They're also giving Olot and Zvachim, and they also establish these stones. There are 12 different stones that they're establishing there. And it's during this covenant that we hear the words Na'aseh V'nishma, that Bnei Israel see this establishment of the stones. They see the Mizbeach. They see that Moshe is writing down the words of Hashem, and they said everything Hashem said, famously, Na'aseh V'nishma, we will do and we will listen. And so it seems here that the covenant that Moshe is saying that you should, Bnei Israel should make when they cross the Yarden into Eretz Kanaan, they should reestablish this very same covenant on Har Eval. And that's the middle section of our Parsha. And in many ways, this is a really beautiful idea, because essentially what Moshe is saying, perhaps, is that this is a establishment, or maybe even a realization of the initial covenant of Brit Sinai, of the covenant of Sinai. Now Bnei Israel have realized or fulfilled this covenant. Hashem has brought them into Eretz Israel, and now they're able to reestablish and reaffirm their commitment to the Torah and to the mitzvot, which is really a beautiful thing, almost making our own Har Sinai, so to speak, once we fulfilled the promise of returning to our land. And so it makes sense, really, that this section, Brit number two, I added or three, we'll get to that in a second, don't worry if you're confused, but it makes sense that this Brit number two is then followed by the tochacha, followed by the admonition. Why? Because if we don't uphold our end of the deal by keeping to the mitzvot and by holding on to the values of the Torah that Hashem has established for us, then we are deserving of perhaps really terrible things to happen to us. And that's what the Torah is saying. If you don't uphold your end of the deal here, then I'm going to bring the tochacha upon you. And the question, though, really becomes when we're talking about the tochacha in Parshat Ki Tavah, really, this is, again, we have Brit number two, and really this is Tochacha number two. This is the second time we're really hearing anything about this Tochacha, anything about this admonition. We've already heard it at the end of Sefer Vayikra in Parshat Bechukotai. And there in Parshat Vayikra, it's mentioned in for perhaps different reasons, but it is mentioned, it's really established in Sefer Vayikra. And it seems to be reiterated in some different ways here in Parshat Ki Tavah. And so the question is, like anything we ask in Sefer Dvarim, why is it important to retell the Tochacha? And specifically, why is it important to retell it here, connected in some way to this specific second iteration of the Brit? And Rabbi Sack says that there are many people talk about this. What are the differences and what are the similarities between the two tochachot, the one in Sefer Vayikra and the one in Sefer Dvarim? And Rabbi Sacks talks about how there are three differences between the tochachot, and I'll outline some of them for us. The first is, of course, in our parsha in Ki Tavah, our version of the Tochacha is spoken by Moshe Rabbeinu. The Tochacha in Vayikra is spoken by Hashem, is said by Hashem, which makes sense because Dvarim is the speech by Moshe. Interestingly, in Dvarim, the Tochacha is first person singular. So it's Arur Ata Ba'ir. So you shall be cursed in your city. Arur Tan'acha U'mish'arecha. Cursed be your basket and your kneading bowl. So that's all singular, just you as an individual. The Tochacha b'chukotai is second person. Venatati panai bachem. I am going to set my face against you as the whole nation, which is a clear difference between the Tochachot. The second difference is, the third difference, excuse me, is the most glaring difference really between the Tochachot, is that our version of the Tochacha ends with a punishment that we will return to Egypt. V'heshivcha Hashem Mitzrayim ba'aniyot ba'derech asher amarti lecha lo tosif ot lirota. And Hashem is going to send us back to Egypt on ships. The translation here says galleys, by a route I told you should not see again. And the Tochacha in Vayikra ends with consolation. V'zacharti lahem brit rishonim asher hotzeti otam me'eretz Mitzrayim le'enei hagoyim liyot lahem l'elohim ani Hashem. That Hashem will remember the covenant, and I remember you who I took out of Egypt. And essentially, a little bit later on, he says he'll return Bnei Israel to their land. And the Ramban actually comments and says, well, the difference between these two Tochachot is that the one in Vayikra is actually talking about the Korban, the destruction of the first temple of Bayit Rishon. And the Tochacha in Ki Tavo in our Parsha is talking about the Korban, the destruction of Bayit Sheni. And all the horrible things that are mentioned that will happen to us in B'chukotai happened during that first destruction of the temple, and all the terrible things that happened in mentioned in Dvarim and Ki Tavo happened in the second temple. And why the difference in ending? Well, the Ramban says that's very easy. We actually return to the land after Bayit Rishon, but we're still waiting to return to the land after Bayit Sheni. And so, of course, the second Tochacha can't actually end with anything positive because we're still awaiting that level, that positivity to come. We're still waiting for Hakamad Bayit Shlishi, which is an interesting, I think, an interesting take maybe on the Tochachot. But what's, I think, most interesting about our specific Tochacha is the way that it ends very specifically with Hashem returning us specifically to Mitzrayim ba'aniyot on these ships. If we think about the Tochacha, if we think about the Tochacha in Ki Tavo and also in B'chukotai, the way that it's set up is that it starts with maybe some of the lighter things that will happen to us. Maybe we won't have a good crop year. Things won't be as good for us financially. And then it quickly devolves into horrible things happen to us. Our enemies are going to come in and kill us. Things are going to become so dire and horrible that we will, God forbid, be driven to eating children, those kinds of horrible things. And it escalates and escalates and escalates. And in the Tochacha and Ki Tavo, this pinnacle or this peak of the most horrible thing that can happen is Veheshivcha Hashem Mitzrayim Ba'aniyah. That we're going to return to Mitzrayim on ships, which is very curious. Why is that really the way to end the crescendo? Why is that the worst possible thing that can happen to us, according to the Tochacha in Parshat Ki Tavo? And I think in order to understand what's happening here and how the Tochacha is being used specifically in Ki Tavo, we have to understand the framing of Sefer Dvarim a little bit better. And I would like to turn to a book that was recently translated from Hebrew into English by a very famous philosopher now, a Torah scholar named Micha Goodman, who is, I think he was named in 2019, one of the most influential thinkers in Israel. And his book was recently this year translated into English, which is called The Last Words of Moses. And Micha Goodman explains that the Tochacha, while it ends with Veheshivcha Hashem Mitzrayim Ba'aniyot, really the theme of the Tochacha is the punishment of Egypt. And if you look through these psukim in our Tochacha, you'll notice that there are really, really salient themes that come to light about Mitzrayim. Yadbek Hashem b'chad hadever, Hashem is going to make pestilence cling to you. V'hayita mimashesh betzaharayim kahasher yimashesh iver ba'afela. You're going to grope around like a blind groping in the darkness. Yachacha Hashem bashkin. Hashem is going to afflict you with severe inflammation, right, with these boils. And zera rav tzotzia sadeh ma'at te'esoh ti'yichaslenu ha'arbe. So you can take as much seed as you want to the field, but you're not going to yield any crops because the arbe, the locusts, are going to consume it. And of course, these psukim outline some of the makot that Hashem afflicted upon the Egyptians. And what Micha Goodman essentially says is that the entire Sefer Dvarim, and with it the Tochacha, is not just that we're repeating the other books of the Torah, Shmot, Vayikra, and Bamidbar, but we have to look at a little bit deeper about what the theme really of Sefer Dvarim is in order to understand this almost obsession or the theme of Mitzrayim in the context of our Tochacha here. And what Micha Goodman says is that Bnei Yisrael, we must remember, are on the brink of entering into Eretz Yisrael. Here they are in Arvat Moav, around here, and they're on the brink of entering Eretz Yisrael, and they're about to experience like a seismic shift in their reality. They are going from being a nomadic people, a people who are entirely reliant on Hashem, recently or historically recently released slaves, and they're going to become a people who are the superpower, the power of this piece of land. And they're going to go from this virtual anonymity, this very small nation, people sort of start to hear about them as they're winning some of these wars around here, to a nation that's just going to be powerful in their own land. And says Micha Goodman, and before we get there, and so Micha Goodman is really outlining for us where Bnei Israel are in the times of Dvarim. And it always, when he talks about this, it always reminds me of this video that I like to watch with my kids, where for those of you who are fans of the Olympics, maybe you'll be familiar with this. But there's this amazing 2012 video. I love Olympic swimming. That's like something, I just really love it. And there's this amazing 2012 video in the London Olympics. And it's the women's 800 meter race, which back then, now there's the 1500 meter race, but it used to be the longest race for females, for female swimmers, the women's 1800 freestyle race. And in that race is 15-year-old Katie Ledecky, who most people know now is one of the greatest swimmers greatest female swimmers, certainly, in the world. And she's a little pizzola, right? She's 15 years old. And she goes out really quickly, and she's swimming. And the commentators are commenting, oh, she went out too fast. Like, who is this kid? What is she doing? On and on. And it's a long race. It's like an 8 or 9 minute race. And she's going and going. And toward the end, she's like a body and a half length ahead of the silver medal. And it becomes obvious in the last 100 or so meters that she is going to take the gold medal. And you're watching this video and you're thinking to yourself, like, this is crazy. In just 1 or 2 minutes, this girl is going to become the gold medalist of the most difficult race in all of swimming in the whole world. But she's not quite there yet. And the commentator kind of realizes, it dawns on her what's going on. And she makes this comment, this young girl is going to become very famous very quickly. And you're like watching this, and you're watching her get to the wall, get to the wall, get to the wall, approach the wall, and she touches the wall, and oh, she becomes Katie Ledecky. And it's exciting, but it's also a little bit frightening, because suddenly she has this enormous, she's like taken up this enormous mantle, and she has in some ways an enormous amount of power that's suddenly been thrust upon her in the world of swimming. And that really is what's happening to Bnei Israel at this time. Very suddenly, they are taking control of this piece of land. And in this very sudden way, they have to grapple with being in power, the power, the ruling power of this piece of land in a way that they never have had to before as a nation. And what Micha Goodman says is that Sefer Dvarim is really about that sudden coming into fame and sudden coming into power, and how Bnei Israel are going to grapple with that power. And so what Micha Goodman says here about the Tochacha, if we come back to our Kitava, is that essentially what Sefer Dvarim is saying is that if Bnei Israel come into the land and they do not keep this brit, they do not uphold the values of the Torah, then they are deserving of the Tochacha. But why specifically deserving of the terrible things that happen to the Mitzrim? Because he says, and I included the quote, power can turn those who fled Egypt into Egyptians themselves. Meaning, if they don't safeguard their power in some way by perhaps upholding, certainly upholding this brit, this middle portion of Parashat Kitavah, of holding close to the values of the Torah as outlined by Hashem and Moshe, then they are at risk of becoming the very slave masters who have just recently freed them, who didn't know how to morally and ethically deal and cope with the amount of power that they had. And so what the Tochacha seems to be saying in some ways is that, Bnei Israel, if you can't uphold your side of this bargain, you have essentially become the Egyptians, and you are worthy of their punishments, which is it's a little dark, I know, but I do think there's something there. And I'm not going to obviously end on the on a very set on a down note. I want to continue and explore how Bikurim fits into this whole picture of the Parsha. But I think we now understand a little bit more of the strength of this link between the Tochacha and the Brit. And so to understand the role of Bikurim, I want to delve a little bit more into what Micha Goodman says about power. And I want to bring an example that he brings in his book, which I think is interesting and salient and will help us understand the role of Bikurim for ourselves here. And Micha Goodman talks about, I included the text in your slides, but I won't read it. I'll tell you the story because I think it's more interesting if we talk about it like this in an animated way. But what Micha Goodman says is for us to imagine that there are two people stranded on a desert island. One is a philosopher, so he has an A plus because he's very smart. And one has a black belt in karate. This is the best I could do, honestly. I'm like terrible at these drawings, but you're all with me, right? Because it's kind of funny. And you have the philosopher and you have the black belt in karate. And the black belt guy has the key to these storehouses over here, which have lots of food. And so he goes and he's getting the food and he's not sharing with anybody. And after they get off this island, somebody says to the philosopher, "Well, why didn't you just beat him up and take the keys?" And the philosopher says, "It's because I'm moral. I would never do that to him. I'm not going to steal from him." And obviously, you're thinking to yourself, "Well, you're not moral. You just don't have any power, right? It's not possible for you to beat him up. He has a black belt in karate. You're a nothing with a good brain, like congratulations, right?" So no one's going to believe that. However, the question then becomes, what happens if the keys rested with the philosopher? He was the one who had access to the storehouses, and the black belt in karate did not steal the keys from the philosopher. And if you say to the black belt in karate, "Well, why didn't you take the keys from the philosopher?" And the black belt in karate says, "Because I have some dignity and I have some morality and I'm not going to beat him up," that would give us pause. That is actually impressive. And so says Micha Goodman, a moral person is one who chooses to be weaker than he really is. Somebody who has power, who's maybe able to beat up on somebody else who could succumb to the worst of his true strength and his true power, and withholds and decides not to. And that is truly a sign of morality. And so I wanted to just bring in a couple quotes from that same page, that same passage. He says, power can be the enemy of morality. And the question is it possible, psychologically speaking, to be both powerful and ethical at the same time? The challenge then for us is to give rules enough power to transform the world for better without being transformed for the worse. And so, says Micha Goodman, this really is what Sefer Dvarim is trying to do. It is trying to confront the power trap that we find ourselves very quickly, in a Katie Ledecky-ish way, maybe, in. That Bnei Israel are now in this trap of power. Are we going to choose to be weaker than we really are, or give power to specific rules that will allow us to transform the world for better without being transformed for the worse? And that, I believe, is where Bikurim comes in here. Bikurim, in essence, is when we bring these the first of our fruits to the Kohen. And I won't read all the psukim, but you have them here for yourselves. And this is in Devarim 26, the beginning of our parsha. And this is an individual, and he's coming, and he brings the first of his fruits that he worked so hard to get in Eretz Yisrael. And he puts them in a basket, and he goes to the place that Hashem will choose, to the Beit HaMikdash. And he comes to the priest, to the Kohen, and Va'amarta Elav, and he says to him, Higadati Hayom LaHashem Elokecha, I'm telling Hashem, Kibati al ha'aretz asher nishpa Hashem lavotenu latet lanu. I came to the land that Hashem promised he would give to us. And the Kohen takes this basket. And then this individual, this farmer, breaks out into a story of his history. And it's the history that we know very well, because that is what's expanded upon every year in the Haggadah. And so I'll read it very quickly, because some of us are at least familiar with it. Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayim. My forefather was a wanderer, and he went down to Mitzrayim. Vayagar Sham Bimtei Me'at, Vayhisham Legoy Gadol Atzum V'Rav. He flourished, he became a large nation. Vayareu Atanu HaMitzrim, Vayanunu, the Mitzrim tortured us. Vayitnu Aleinu Avodah Kasha. They put us under this terrible slave labor. V'nitzak el Hashem Elokei Avotenu, we cried out to Hashem. V'yishma Hashem et kolenu, v'yar et onyenu, v'et amalenu, v'elachatenu. Hashem heard our cries and our pleas and our suffering. V'yatzienu Hashem Mitzrayim b'yad chazaka v'zra'a netuya. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim with a strong hand. U'v'mara gadol, u'be'otot, u'be'maftim. These wonderful things that Hashem did for us, these signs and these miracles. V'yavienu ala makom hazeh. Hashem brought us to this place, and he gave us this wonderful land flowing with milk and honey. And so now I'm bringing the first of my fruits, asher natata li Hashem, v'hinachta lifnei Hashem elokecha, v'ishtachavita lifnei Hashem elokecha. And so I am bringing the first of my fruits to Hashem. And that's the text that we, Avisamachta b'chol atov asher natan Hashem. And if you do this, you will be happy with all the good things that Hashem bestowed upon you. And I want to draw your attention to a few points here in this text, in this Arami Oved Avi story that the farmer is telling to the Kohen. And what he's focused on, really, it's really interesting. The farmer is not at all focusing on any part of Sefer Bereshit. The only thing we see is Arami Oved Avi, that my father was a wanderer, and he goes down to Mitzrayim. Presumably that's Yaakov. And that did happen in Sefer Bereshit. But there's no mention of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov flourishing in the land of Israel, acquiring great wealth in Israel. There's no mention of their establishment in Israel, buying land in Israel. We know all that happened, but that's not the focus at all of this text. The focus really is on our suffering in Egypt, how Hashem took us out of Egypt, ve'avi'enu el hamakom haseh, that Hashem brought us to this land. And because Hashem brought us, we are now bringing something as a gift to Hashem or a supplication to Hashem to thank him for bringing us into this land. And I think that's really interesting that we are really in this story minimizing the times that we were in power in the land. And instead, what the story is actually highlighting is the times that we were at our lowest in the land and how dependent we were on Hashem to bring us into the land, and that we're reminded of this dependence and we're then giving Hashem the first of our fruit. And indeed, the light word, or the most salient word, or the most important word that's repeated in this passage seven times, or some call it a milah mancha, a repeated or a heavy and important word, is noten, to give. That really, the idea behind this passage is that this land is a gift from Hashem, and that we are participating in giving to Hashem as a thank you for bringing us into the land and for giving us the land. And this is a phrase that Micha Goodman calls protective memory, that if we understand Bikurim in this way, then we really have the potential of protecting ourselves against the dangers of the power that are possible, or the dangers of the pitfalls of power that are so salient and so possible for us once we get into that position of power in Eretz Yisrael. And so, interestingly, I think the beginning of our Parsha and the end of our Parsha actually have some nice parallels. The Bikurim story is really a first-person narrative, that it's this one individual telling the story, that Hashem brought me into the land. Arami Oved Avi, my individual father, was a wanderer. Similar to the Tochacha, which is really about that individual piece, that each one of us is supposed to see ourselves as responsible for this potential power trap, which could be countered by the Bikurim and can be devolved into the Tochacha. The Bikurim is really about plenty, that I have so much that I'm able to offer what I have to Hashem. And of course, one of the themes of the Tochacha is that we lack food. We don't have enough food. And that's what happens when we don't uphold the Brit. And of course, both the Bikurim and the Tochacha center very strongly around Egypt. The Bikurim about the redemption of Egypt, and the Tochacha about the return to Egypt. And so I think we can now very much understand the progression of our Parsha, with the Brit in the middle serving as that anchor point of that reestablishment of the wonderful things that Hashem has, the reestablishment of the Torah and our upholding the values of the Torah, that we will reestablish that Brit Sinai when we get into Eretz Yisrael, and that if things devolve, they could devolve into the Tochacha. We would be deserving of the Tochacha, but that it is possible for us to uphold the Brit if we protect ourselves against the dangers of power through the Bikurim, through a protective narrative that reminds us who we are, where we come from, and when we were at our lowest. And I'll just end with a quote from Micha Goodman. He says, when a person is in control, he should remember his servitude. When she is successful, she should remember her dependence. And that truly is perhaps an idea of protecting ourselves against some of the dangers that we could be our own worst enemies, but we can also be responsible for our greatest success. And that, in a nutshell, is my take this week on Parshat Ki Tavo. Shabbat Shalom, everybody. And I'm happy to stay around for some questions.
Thank you. Okay, anybody have any questions, comments?
I'll look at the...
Annie, happy birthday. Okay. You can enjoy the nachas. Those are Rebecca's parents, Annie and Naftali. Okay, say hello. But it's always nice when parents can come to hear a shir of a child. It's a special treat. So, all right, any questions, anybody? Okay, if not, yashar koach, thank you. It's, You left out, of course, the Bidui Maser, how that fits in.
Very good. Hashkifa mimon. That will be the next year we'll do Bidui
Because that's
Maser.
the only like positive hashkifa in the Torah, is
Yeah,
right.
exactly. Yes, exactly.
Okay, just
I have a question.
Please.
It's one of those which has been asked a lot in different time periods. All right, so you have this tochacha that God will do X if we don't do Y. And I went to business school. There's always a risk reward trade-off. Is the risk of this extra punishment worth, in your opinion, the reward? I mean, there's a lot of risk going on. And then, of course, the other part of it is more and more, the older I get, I resent being punished for something that somebody did 100 years ago or 50 years ago. At the very least, I want to be judged as an individual, or at least my generation, and not the sins of previous generations. Now, yes, there is another side to it, that if my parents hadn't left Europe and come to North America, I wouldn't be enjoying this wonderful lifestyle. But there's more to it than just location. So I don't know, all these tochachot, is the rewards for it really that much better than anybody else gets?
I mean, I think that's a complicated general life question that we
Yes,
all
but
have
we
to grapple
believe that
with.
God is talking to us, saying you do X and Y comes out. Is the Y worth the risk of the X?
I mean, I think the Torah, and I mean, I believe yes, but I don't know 100% that you would. In the arc of history, is that re a reward that you personally will see? That's a question, meaning that XY formula is not necessarily a personal formula, which is frustrating.
But they're also talking about different things. If I the punishment is material, your crops, your slavery, your body, and the reward seems to be spiritual. Not that I'm getting 20 times more crops than the guy in the country over. I'm going to be depressed, but lots of people are depressed. So they're not equivalent things, which also bothers me. So I'm going
Say
to be
that
happy
again.
that I don't have a lot of crops because I think God is smiling on me, but I'm still hungry.
Well, say that again. I didn't quite understand that line
That
of
all
thinking.
right, it might just be, it's often said it's your attitude that changes, not the material stuff. Yeah, so I can say, thank God I get something out of the crops, but I'm still hungry if they're not adequate. The fact that I think God is smiling on me doesn't help my empty stomach.
But I mean, in Sefer Dvarim, the reward would be, even though this is not always reality, but the reward would be plentiful, that you would have crops, even though that's not always the case. But Sefer Dvarim is not saying that necessarily. Meaning the punishment seems to be that you wouldn't have a lot of crops. Your attitude could be anything toward that. But that doesn't seem to be what Sefer Dvarim is going to be. We all know is meaning we all know that life doesn't work like that. Sometimes you'll be a great person and you still won't have a lot of crops. But I'm not quite understanding maybe your question or the line of thinking.
Well, it's just, is this worth the risk reward trade-off? In other words, you're stuck with a framework because it exists in the Torah. But you're a bright, educated woman. If you were starting from scratch and trying to do something, would it be this formula or would it be something else that seemed to be more, I understand that you're stuck with the framework, but that doesn't mean that I can't imagine a better framework.
Interesting. I mean, I would say I'm as educated as I am not as educated as those who of the Torah giants, and definitely I wouldn't say as expansive as the Torah is in its formula. So I would never deign to come up with a different one. But if you have one, I'm open to hearing.
I mean, Yossi, you're basically, if I may, you're basically discussing the whole problem of reward and punishment, tzaddik v'ra'lo. I mean, you're just discussing it in
Well, we're dealing
a
with
different way.
tafakot, so of course,
Yeah,
and I'm also
if
dealing
you
with
ask the
history.
question. So it's an unanswerable question. I mean, it goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu already asked God about that, the Gemara says. And of course, but the Torah's rewards generally are all material. That's what some of the medieval philosophers are bothered with. Why does the Torah always talk about rewards, more crops? And, it never talks about spiritual rewards. Torah never talks about Olam Haba, never talks about Yom HaMashiach. It's always, there'll be peace, which is a great reward, of course, but there'll be good crops and your animals won't miscarry and you won't miscarry and et cetera. That's the way the Torah does it. You can put it in historical perspective, who it was talking to, if you want to take sort of the Rambam's approach, which many people don't like. At the time, that's the only thing that people getting Torah could understand. Or, I know you have to give another approach. Why exactly the Torah does that? The Torah is concerned with here and there, but you're not really raising in, Rebecca, I don't want to say anything you don't want to say. I'm just going to
No, I agree totally.
compliment.
I think it is unanswerable. And you're raising the EOV question, like Rabbi Kamen said, a question that's age old, really, in the Torah.
Practicality. So you had the 70, you mentioned the first Tochacha, the second Tochacha, the first temple, the second temple. But 70 years would have been, I wouldn't have waited 70 years. I probably would have lost faith. And Adarabba, 1700 years from the end of the Mishnaic period, I understand why people left. And I actually think they're doing the right decision. It's these dreamers who kept on, for various reasons. You're going to have an 1800 a year gap. Of course, people are going to leave, and the majority.
Right. That's
Right.
why there are only
Yeah.
14 million of us in the world.
Right. Right.
It's not all persecution. That's, Muslims and Christians were killing each other just as much as they were killing Jews. Of course, the Holocaust, a lot of it is, of course, most Jews throughout history have assimilated. And that's with time true from the first exile. Most Jews who went to Babylon in 586 never came back. They were lost to the Jewish people.
Right.
And you go to Spain, I don't know, two-thirds of people in Spain's great-great-great-grandparents in the 15th century were Jews. Half of Spain was like that. That's the way it is.
Rabbi Kelman,
Yes.
it's Debbie Sondheim.
How are you?
Baruch Hashem.
Good.
When my students always ask me this, I generally say that I'm not God's accountant. That we can't understand the way God does the
Of course.
figures things out. And I can't even try to guess and try to do the din v'cheshbon of how if I would have thought things differently, because I don't have God's mind. I don't know how the world was created, just like the Eov answer. Were you there when I created the world? I couldn't even venture to ask that question because I can't equate myself and figure out, second guess that. That's why I wouldn't ask that. That's my answer.
All right. Yeah, we're
But
actually with
following along with that, then I can't say anything is good or bad. If I can't label something as bad, I can't label something as good. I didn't get
No, you can
smart
label it
when I
bad.
see
Yes,
the
yeah, so you can
good,
label it
and I
bad.
didn't get stupid when I see the bad.
No, we're not saying it's not bad. When we say tzaddik v'ra'lo, we're saying it is bad. We're not
Where
denying
is bad?
that.
Just can't ask why
Right.
that.
We don't understand it, but it's not that we're saying it's good. I mean, that's a, whatever God does is for the good. That's not what we're saying here. We're saying it is bad, but we just don't understand it. All right, anybody else has any other questions? We're not going to solve this philosophical. I mean, no, it's an important question. Of course, it's an important question, but it's impossible. So, Debbie, I can't resist saying, they say that we teachers, whatever, we're in sales, not management. So, that's
Great answer.
okay. Yeah.
Very good. I like that.
Yeah. Okay. If let me answer any questions. Okay. By the way, I'll have to send that email actually tonight. My shiur tomorrow is back to 9:15. We had a 2 week hiatus or whatever. We went to 9:45 tomorrow. My shiur, which is on the machzor, not on the siddur. We switched last week, 2 weeks ago, last week to doing the machzor. So that'll be 9:15, our regular Friday morning slot. Sunday, of course, I just put the registration for those who haven't registered. It's a different registration. You can't get in the regular registration. Mark Dratch, Rabbi Mark Dratch, Rabbi Ari Schwat, Leah Silver, Rabbi Liktav, Rev Stav, Racheli Taubes. We have a wonderful program Sunday morning, 9:15 to 1:30, 40 minutes each with 1 15-minute break. So that's to prepare a little bit for Rosh Hashanah. And then we'll have the regular classes during the week next week and 2 weeks today, first day of Rosh Hashanah already. Okay. But and you know, you cannot say that to already. What do you mean already? Rosh Hashanah is in October this year. It never gets later than this year. I think, oh, it's Rosh Hashanah already? You know, just wait in 3 years. Rosh Hashanah is on September 5th, okay? I don't know. Whenever Rosh Hashanah is, we're never ready. It's like Shabbos, summer, winter, doesn't matter. Whenever Shabbos is, you're 10 minutes late to shul. It doesn't matter. 8:30 left benching or 4:30 left benching. Okay. Anyways, thank you, Rebecca. Always a pleasure. And
yes,
any tips? Are you coming to visit anytime soon?
Not for Chagim, unfortunately.
Not for Chagim.
I'll talk to my parents.
That's it. I'll talk to your parents too. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Laila Tov, everybody.
Laila Tov. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Thanks.
Shabbat Shalom. Laila Tov. Tadarabah.
Bakasha.